Live from Western Canada, welcome to The Kindling's Muse. Intelligent, imaginative, hospitable explorations of ideas that matter most in contemporary life. And now here's your host, Bill Hogg.
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, lads and lassies. Welcome to The Kindlings. A warm welcome to those of you who are here as part of our live supper audience at Bell's in South Surrey in beautiful British Columbia. And a warm welcome to those of you who've found us at thekindlings.ca and who are consuming this podcast even as we speak. I am Bill Hogg, intergalactic evangelist, flying Scotsman, a pastor of Grace Point Community Church and your friendly neighborhood Kindlings host. Tonight, we get into conversation about television's longest-running sitcom, The Simpsons. And I have our illustrious panel of Kindlings with me this evening to help us explore the gospel according to The Simpsons. Joining me this evening is Dr. Alison Jewell, author and co-director, yes, indeed, of the Gender Studies Institute at Trinity Western University and an unabashed Lisa Simpson fan. Also joining me is Simpsons fanboy and encyclopedia of all things cinematic, movie critic, movie buff, Peter Chataway. Last but by no means least, you loathe him as Lex Luthor, but we love him as Kevin Miller, screenplay writer, movie director, and cultural gadfly. Please give a warm welcome to Kevin Miller. It's now in its 21st season. It has spanned two decades with over 450 episodes, and to date, one feature-length movie. The Simpsons is a global phenomenon. In 1997, The Simpsons surpassed The Flintstones as the longest-running primetime animated series in the history of U.S. television. In 2004, The Simpsons replaced The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet, which ran from 52 to 66 and was a personal favorite of Peter Chataway's, as the longest-running sitcom, animated or live-action, in the history of U.S. television. This animated mainstay features the first family of Springfield, Homer, Marge, Bart, Lisa, and baby Maggie. And tonight, we're here to explore the gospel according to The Simpsons. So get the ball rolling, Kevin. The Simpsons just celebrated its 20th anniversary this year. It's been running on network TV as a primetime show for two full decades. Why does it continue to be so popular?
Well, I mean, that's a great question. I'm somebody who probably watched it faithfully for the first 10 to 12 seasons. And what for me kept drawing me back again and again was, what outlandish thing is Homer going to do next? And I don't know what's keeping it alive today. Is it just the fact that it's been alive so long now that it's kind of living on borrowed time? I have no idea. Is it still as good as it used to be? Honestly, I can't really give a fair assessment, but I think that, you know, the idea of this show, you almost, to really appreciate the genius of the show, you have to have really probably enjoyed it in the context of the, say, mid-1990s, when I think it was really hitting the, you know, the cultural nerve. And I think what it was doing was what all great satire does, is it just helps us sort of laugh at our own kind of obsessions and idiosyncrasies. It really was kind of playing the role of the trickster and pointing out the places where we're being the most ridiculous.
Okay. I would go back even earlier than the mid-1990s. The characters were first invented for short little one-minute segments on the Tracy Ullman show in 1987. Right. And at the time, and then it expanded to a sitcom with a Christmas special in 1989. And so it was, the show's roots go back to the late Reagan era. And at the time, the show was seen as a response to shows like The Cosby Show, where The Bill Cosby Show presented this very idealized version of family life. And a lot of people said, well, this isn't very realistic. It's too perfect. And so The Simpsons came along, and The Simpsons was anything but perfect. And I think a lot of people responded to the show at the time because it was subverting sort of the myth of the perfect family that Cosby was putting forward. And because I responded to it, a lot of my friends responded to it back then, because it felt like The Simpsons was more realistic than The Cosby Show was. The kinds of stresses that the family goes through, but survives. It survives through those stresses. Why the show is still popular now? I think it's partly, or why does it still continue now? Partly, I think it's because the basic concept, mother, father, few kids, it's very simple. Everybody can relate to it on some level. And because the show has gone in this postmodern direction of making gags about everything topical, whether it's cultural, pop cultural, political, whatever, there's always new material that can be brought into the show, and there's always new gags they can make and new jokes they can make. And after a while, there was a time in the 90s when I noticed that parents were watching the show with their kids. And so it's become this thing that gets passed on through generations now.
Do you think that it would depend on how old you were at different points of its popularity? Like in the early 90s when it was just kicking off, I was a young mom with two kids, a boy and a girl, a Bart and a Lisa. And
is that what you called your
no,
kids?
No, I didn't. I didn't.
Oh, okay, I just wanted to clarify because I know Tony Campolo, who looks like Homer Simpson, his wife is Margaret and his kids are Bart and Lisa. So I just wanted to clarify if that was the case.
No, they have different names. That's fine. But what I remember being critical of it at the beginning because I was nervous about it portraying the satire of family life, but critiquing family life just at a time I was trying to establish something beautiful and amazing. And I found The Cosby Show, by comparison, more inspiring, safer.
Yeah, Cliff Huxtable is by far a much safer pair of paternal hands than Homer the buffoon Simpson.
Yeah, and I distinctly remember conversations at the time, this is over coffee with other moms and dads, and the concern we were having for our young boys, because this was right around the time that the underachievement of boys was just first hitting the, attention of schools and universities, and what's going to happen to our boys if we continue to dumb down masculinity, whether it was in The Simpsons or the Dumb and Dumber movies, that there was something problematic, perhaps, in portraying masculine characters as, oafs and, kind of out of it. And
so, admittedly, it's the portrayal, albeit animated, of a dysfunctional family. So, back when it came out, George H.W. Bush was critical of it and made comments that Americans should aspire to be much more like the Waltons than the Simpsons. And so the Waltons were held up as the idealized family rather than the primetime competition of the African-American Huxtables. So it's a sitcom about a dysfunctional family. What is it saying about marriage and about family? What can we glean from the show? What kind of statement is it making about family?
Well, I think it sounds like George H.W. Bush believes what Homer Simpson believes, is that you don't find the truth at the bottom of a bottle, you find it on TV. And, if you go, anyone who goes to The Simpsons to try and find out how they should run their family, I think has some other issues. But, because clearly it's not meant to be prescriptive of how we should live. It's meant to be sort of more having fun with it. But sorry, in terms of the question, I need to have that refreshed.
Okay, so what comments would you make on the relationship? So you've got a husband and a wife who stick with each other through thick and thin, and Homer's crazy schemes and ineptitude. And then you've got the baby who's silent, Bart, who was labeled underachiever, proud of it, and the precocious 8-year-old Lisa.
Well, I think certainly in the early days, I'm not quite sure where the series is now in this regard. I know that at some point in the 90s, the show became more concerned with the jokes than with what I might call the heart of the family. But certainly in the early years, the first 5, 6, 7 years, the characters did have a definite love for each other, even if it sometimes got filtered through these very dysfunctional ways of dealing with each other. There are some lovely episodes where, I mean, episodes dealing with Homer's shock when he found out that Marge was pregnant with Maggie, and yet it turns out that he loves Maggie very much, and he keeps pictures of her in his office at the nuclear power plant, things like that. There are some genuinely heartwarming moments in the series. And the fact that they can love each other and stick together despite their dysfunctions could be a positive thing. I don't want to hold up The Simpsons as an example people should follow, but I do think that people relate to The Simpsons in a way that role models might not be so easy to relate to. And I think that they relate to The Simpsons still for now because The Simpsons do represent sort of not an ideal but a baseline ideal. Like they are together. They haven't split up.
Right.
The Milhouses may have split up. Ned Flanders, his wife, may have died. All the other families around them have had their problems. But I think, for example, if Homer and or Marge ever cheated on the other, and I hope there hasn't been an episode where that did happen and I missed it. But
they came close.
Homer was tempted. Yeah.
Well, they've both been tempted multiple times. But I think if either of them ever actually did go through with it, I think a lot of audience sympathy for them would just die. And I think the show would jump the shark.
Is it that they're dysfunctional, or is it that they're functional in ways that are just honest and real? They're still together.
Yeah, I don't disagree that they're dysfunctional. I one thing I think about, if we want to bring up gender, is I'm trying to think of one positive male role model in the show. I'm trying to think of one guy.
Ned Flanders.
Yeah, but he's got his own kind of, he's in massive denial, you know, of huge parts of his personhood. I'm trying to think of a single guy who kind of, it seems to be.
But are there female role models? I mean, even.
Lisa.
But even she has definite problems and issues that she has to deal with.
She's annoying, Kevin says.
She's not. She's lovely. She's amazing. She never lets you down. She's smart. She's topical. She's well-read.
But to me, I just think about it. It's every you got Otto, you got Krusty, you got you got Apu, you got Principal Skinner. You have every male dysfunction you can think of on the show.
You've got Willie.
Is it saying that men Scottish have no place in the 1990s? Is that what it was saying? I don't know. I'm just trying to.
Well, it's interesting on the issue of gender roles. At one point, Homer has a conversation with his 8-year-old phenom Lisa and says, "Lisa, if the Bible has taught us nothing else, and it hasn't, it's that girls should stick to girls' sports such as hot oil wrestling and foxy boxing and such and such." So that's Homer giving voice to what gender roles are. How do you react to that, Allison?
Okay, yeah.
I just found that especially for you.
Thank you so much for that.
Hey, you're welcome.
Yeah, I think there are problems with gender in the show, and I think it's possible that that's exactly the point, is that it's trying to poke fun of even gender politics at the time. Certainly Lisa and Marge have a kind of strength of character that is much more inspiring than the male characters, that's true. And yet there are also episodes where the gender conversation, like I'm thinking of Girls Just Want to Have Sums, that episode, where the principal of the school is telling in the assembly that girls aren't good at math because they're not, you know, and yet they're of course doing much better than the boys of their grade. So there's this kind of social commentary on what is happening, all the while stumbling over what it means or what it, you know, what the consequences might be. I do think it's no coincidence that Marge is a stay-at-home mom the whole time, and you know, what does that really say about Lisa's prospects? I mean, we don't get to see these kids grow up. Over 20 years, they've stayed the same age. It would be interesting, if you could, to kind of imagine what would happen next for them and what would happen to Lisa. I mean, if Lisa does grow up with all her brilliance and still, because of societal pressures, chooses this disappointing avenue, and yet Bart might make it, you know, all the way to the top or something. That would be frustrating.
But there's that word again.
Yeah, sorry, I was trying to avoid it. But
you've got an affirmation of the feminine in the person of Lisa, because the show obviously makes political commentary along the way. It consistently flags up issues of political corruption, and environmentalism is a running theme. And the voice of social consciousness, more often than not, is Lisa Simpson.
Yes. But what would happen to such a person long term? It would be really interesting to somehow imagine what would happen to her as a grown woman.
I don't know if I'd be interested in watching that one.
Sorry, I'm just wondering, is this an okay time to bring up the fact that a lot of people I know don't like the Lisa Simpson's episodes all that much because they say those are always the preachiest episodes?
Lowest ratings ever.
Really? Yeah. Sure, bring it up, Peter. Bring it on, Peter.
I don't know. I mean, and this is, I don't see this as a reflection on her gender, by the way. I bring it up because Lisa is the voice of a lot of political commentary, but whenever the show becomes its most didactic, I mean, the show is perhaps a little weaker than it could be. I mean, and even when it does bring in the political issues, sometimes the funniest moments in those episodes are when they actually subvert the political message. You know, Lisa does her whole environmental thing, and she gets Mr. Burns to become more aware of the environment, and they find a fish on the beach that's trapped inside one of those, what do you call those things, those plastic rings that beer cans come in? I don't know.
It's a
plastic ring, anyway.
Okay, plastic ring.
So the fish is trapped in this thing, and so they take it and they throw it out into the sea, and there it's free. And the moment it's in the sea, another fish comes up and eats it. You know, so even there, you know, it sort of takes this politicized view of the environment, where the environment is this wonderful thing we must all respect, and then it sort of throws the nature red in tooth and claw aspect of the environment at you, and sort of, you know, and there's a bit of an incongruity there, and it's funny, and the funniest aspect of the show is the way it subverts the political soapboxing, if you will.
And you can't really criticize it for being a satire when it is wanting to be a satire.
Oh, absolutely, so, yeah.
I mean,
and it satirizes itself, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it shows no mercy.
And there seems to be a consistent, which, of course, is consistent with the postmodern spirit, a consistent hostility to institutions. So Mayor Quimby is corrupt, Police Chief Wiggum is inept and corrupt, Timothy Lovejoy is unctuous, boring, and hypocritical, and Montgomery Burns is the embodiment of the creepiness and nastiness of corporate America. So what do we make of that, Kevin?
Yeah, I mean, it clearly is very suspicious of authority. Like, I mean, if we're going to talk about the religious aspect, you look at its treatment of Reverend Lovejoy versus its treatment of Flanders. I mean, Flanders is a good guy who's just sort of trying to do his best, you know, whereas Lovejoy, who knows if he ever believed anything, you know. He's just sort of playing a game, I guess, to get a pension. I don't know what he's there for. But the interesting thing, too, is that Springfield wouldn't be on the map unless Mr. Burns and his evil corporation was there, which is kind of, you know, analogous to the world in which we live, which everyone loves to rail against the corporations, but let's face it, we all live on their largesse, like it or not.
But the flip side of this, though, is that the institutions in Springfield are all very local. I mean, the big corporate power, for some reason, the guy who runs the company actually lives right there in Springfield. So it is possible for these characters...
So he's not a faceless mogul running a
corporation. The people who live in Springfield can actually have a relationship with him on some level, whereas, you know, we look at the power companies and the fast food joints and all the various big corporations in our neighborhoods. Do we know who runs these things? I mean, they're probably in some completely different city from us, and we have no control over that. Whereas in Springfield, it still retains this almost small town view of America where everything is like nearby.
Kevin, you and I were chatting this afternoon before the show, and you'd mentioned Krusty being a kind of straw man to attack celebrity.
Yeah. Yeah, one of my favorite episodes is when Bart realizes that Krusty's a bit of a fraud, and he, you know, gets on his case for lending his name to an inferior piece of merchandise, which is something Bart Simpson certainly would never do. And Krusty laments that, "Oh, they backed a dump truck of money up to my house. What was I going to do?" You know, I mean, I think it. Yeah, I think he's a stand-in for all that's wrong with the world of celebrity. But you know, there's certain times. There's a time I remember as well. It was the episode where Homer hated pants for some reason, but where Krusty...
That's a few episodes, I think. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, where Krusty redeems himself, though, I think he kind of sees the light. But yeah, he seems to be, again, it's yet another... I mean, celebrities are nowadays a cultural authority, and it's another way of skewering them.
And speaking of Krusty, we can't mention Krusty tonight without mentioning at least once that the character's name was inspired by the name of a Christian clown called Rusty Nails. And Matt Groening named the character Krusty the Clown partly because he thought Rusty Nails was the most horrifying name imaginable for a children's entertainer. And yeah, so it was inspired by that.
There we are. Trivia from Peter Chataway. As Matt Groening actually drew a lot of the characters and their names from boyhood influences in Portland, Oregon. So, and I just sounded like the mailman from Cheers all of a sudden with that pop culture trivia. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we want to explore the theology of The Simpsons, because unlike that wholesome Huxtable family, there's a lot of praying, there's a lot of church going, there's a lot of preaching, and there's a lot of talk about God, Jesus, heaven, hell, and Satan in Springfield. So all that to look forward to when we come back for the Kindlings. We'll take a break right now. Thank you. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, lads and lassies. Bill Hawke here, host of The Kindlings in beautiful Western Canada. And we're about to dig a little deeper into the gospel according to The Simpsons in the company of Kevin Miller, Alison Jewell, and Peter Chataway. The Simpsons show consistently tackles religion, belief, God, and spirituality. Matt Groening, who was one of the show's co-founders and co-creators, said, "Right-wingers complain there's no God on TV. Not only do The Simpsons go to church every Sunday and pray, they actually speak to God from time to time. We show him, and God has five fingers, unlike The Simpsons, who only have four." In the movie, The Simpsons, old Abe Simpson has a Pentecostal moment in church where he has a prophetic word, ends up rolling around on the floor. At one point, we think he's speaking in tongues, Ipa, 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 but he's actually prophesying the rather invasive involvement of the fictitious Environmental Protection Agency. In season two, in the episode Bart Gets an F, Bart prays for God to shut down the school, and the Almighty intervenes by sending a snowstorm. Throughout the 21 seasons of The Simpsons, prayer is consistently featured. God, Jesus, and Satan have been depicted on the show, and last night's episode in season 21, which aired March 28th, 2010, the episode was called "The Greatest Story Ever Told," and the show opens with Homer disrupting Flanders' Bible study with his noisy backyard antics, and Reverend Lovejoy coaxing Ned Flanders into taking the entire Simpsons family on a Bible study trip to the Holy Land. So, in light of all of this, and the fact that some of the episodes focus singularly on religious themes, how should we understand the show's treatment of Christianity?
Well, I think it's used as fodder for laughs, just like its treatment of Republicanism and Democrats and Hinduism and Judaism and pretty much anything. You know, I think that's probably one of the main uses of it. But at the same time, I mean, there are some consistent things in terms of Homer Simpson, where the last thing that he'll resort to is prayer, which is probably par for the course for most people who watch the show, is the last thing that you'll resort to is prayer. And there seems to be some pretty hard and fast rules of karma as well in the show, in terms of you reap what you sow. I think that there's a pretty solid cosmology in terms of certain types of behaviors are rewarded and certain types of behaviors are punished. Who does the rewarding? Who does the punishment? Sometimes it's God. Sometimes it's Jeebus. Sometimes it's aliens. But I don't know. I kind of sense that there is a consistency on one level. Anyway.
It is a moral universe.
Springfield's
part of a moral universe.
Yeah.
And do you think that it's just being honest, too, about the American population that has a huge evangelical Christian following, like 70 million plus that are genuinely connected to a faith? Is it just presenting the fact that American life is riddled with issues of religion and spirituality and faith?
So are you asking, is it accurately, is it mirroring American spiritual life? I mean, I would say Springfield's unusual in that most of the Springfielders show up at church. You know, it's a sanctuary that maybe holds 150, but from time to time, it seems like there's a full house.
Except, of course, for people like Apu, who's Hindu, or Krusty, who's Jewish or something. But yeah, it seems like almost the entire community ends up in that congregation at some point.
But I think that there are American towns where that isn't far off the truth.
Maybe in the heartland, maybe in rural Kansas. But I would contend that it misrepresents that because there is an antipathy towards institutions. And there's a marginalization of the institution of the church. You know, what sociologists would call liminality, that religious institutions are increasingly on the margins of a post-Christian or post-modern or pre-Christian America.
And yet I don't feel laughed at, even as a woman or an educator or a churchgoer. I don't feel laughed at in the jokes. I feel like it's poking fun at things we take seriously, because even things we take very seriously, there are weaknesses, flaws, unconsidered views, patterns, and habits that we haven't explored.
Well, in 21 years, they've made a lot of jokes about religion on some level or other, and some of them I would say I probably do feel laughed at, but I tend not to remember those ones very well. The ones that stick with me are the ones that actually sort of reflect things that I've experienced in my own life as a Christian, some of the obsessiveness people can have. I was just talking to Kevin beforehand about how there's one episode where Ned Flanders leaves a message on his pastor's voicemail saying, "Pastor, I'm really concerned. I think I might be coveting my own wife." There's another one where Ned Flanders' kids are watching a cartoon, a typical Sunday morning cartoon, with like a big papa sheep and a couple of baby sheep, and the papa sheep has just forgiven one of the baby sheep for his sins, whatever they were, and the other sheep then says, "Oh, I wish I had some sins too, so I could be forgiven." And the papa sheep says, "You do have a sin. You have the sin of envy." Oh, yay! So if you grow up in that environment, it's the kind of things, especially if you grow up in that environment, that you sort of obsess over or puzzle over, are you going too far with this, too far with that? And the fact that the show makes light of that in a way that I can identify with, I think it helps bring a certain perspective to my own religious life at the best of times. There are jokes which probably go too far and just outright mocking it, but there's a mix of things in there.
So how do we interpret, how do we draw distinctions? So in the movie, Homer's flapping his gums to the family about the church and talking about the morons and their phony baloney God, and they can't hear. You've got Lovejoy, who's a target of some of the swipes. So are they taking a swipe against religious institutions? Because I think there's a fairly sympathetic view of individual belief or individual piety. So how do we understand there the posture when it comes to faith, spirituality, and say the Christian faith?
Well, I think there's also a sympathy toward God in a sense too. Like I know there's an episode where God and Homer kind of have a dialogue about how ridiculous it is to have to sit through church on Sunday morning and all you are going to hear about is how you're going to go to hell. And God's like, "Yeah, sometimes I'd rather watch the football game too," you know, that sort of thing. But you know, it seems to me when I think about religion on The Simpsons, even if you look at someone like Apu, is that they're clinging to an old idea of religion because there's no substitute. There's nothing really, it's not like any of it is relevant to anybody, but what else are we going to do? You know, that's what it seems to be, what's going on in the show. It's kind of interesting that someone like Reverend Lovejoy has never become like Rick Warren, or kind of latched on to something like the church growth movement or any of these sort of trends that have swept through. you know, evangelicalism. I don't know what the latest one is, but that whole Prayer of Jabez thing, that sort of thing, you never really saw, we haven't seen the church progress on The Simpsons when I think about it, you know, in the way that it has, you know, because evangelicalism is based around what's the latest, greatest thing that I'm going to get that's going to make me the new cutting-edge Christian. You don't really see that happening there.
Which might be a reflection of the lives of the creative forces behind The Simpsons. I think as it's Mike Scully, who is a lapsed Catholic, so they're maybe not in a position to give us inside analysis or deconstruction of evangelicalism in particular, because that's not part of their particular story.
Well, they're also now several steps removed from the actual production of the show, right? Whereas at the beginning, the creators and the key creative team were probably writing episodes or at least supervising, whereas now, you know, who knows even how much active involvement they have in the show.
But the church that's portrayed is a Protestant church, and you could make the case that it actually is the evangelical church that's being represented. It's not the Catholic or
Orthodox. Well, it's the Presbylutherans. It's a kind of fictitious representation of mainline Protestantism, which, of course, Lisa might have been the embodiment of liberal mainline Protestantism until she took flight and became a Buddhist, you know, at one point. So,
but she's the only hint of any kind of religious progressivism in the show.
And it's because she's the smart one. Intellectual people are open to new ideas and
right, yeah.
things like that.
But you could say that whether it's the religion or the education system or the politics, those things are surrounding the family life. The Simpsons, the title and the focus of the show is how they are trying to stay connected to each other. And the other forces are kind of backdrops.
Well, it raises an interesting question, though, just about the family. Like, why is Marge... I mean, she's there for the kids, I guess. But, you know, they're almost clinging to a family structure that no longer seems to be relevant either. But what else do we do, you know? I mean, do we become like the Milhouses? You know what I mean? I kind of get that sense a little bit. There's a little bit of a despair and yet a comfort that somehow these institutions had a meaning at one point. We just don't remember what they are. Like maybe it is actually just Planet of the Apes.
Well, and Bart's modeled after the bad kid in Leave It to Beaver, whose name suddenly escapes me. But there is this kind of longing for an intact family, albeit a dysfunctional family. I mean, they love each other. They stick together. And albeit that Abe Simpson, the doddering grandfather, is treated with contempt, he's still included in family life. But on the spirituality of The Simpsons, it's quite remarkable that a primetime television show continues to portray spirituality and faith. Like the show that was on primetime TV last night has Homer proclaiming he's the Messiah after a visitation from animated vegetables in the desert that look very much like VeggieTale characters. There's a tomato, a cucumber, and a gherkin. So clearly they're aware of that part of evangelical subculture. And Homer's mission in that hotbed of sectarianism and bigotry is to unite all faiths. So he pops up to try and get the Christians, the Jews, and the Muslims together. But as they head home on the plane, the plane is populated by false messiahs with their garb. And then you've got Flanders, the evangelical, who's sitting there with his specs and the sweater that he always wears. So how would you understand that? I mean, is that a swipe at all things sacred? They seem to leave the Catholic Church alone. They're happy to take a swipe, perhaps, at Scientology with the movementarians. But what's the agenda, if there isn't an agenda?
There was an episode a few years ago where Homer began spending time with a priest played by a Catholic priest played by Liam Neeson, and you know, a lot of the gags in there about Catholicism were essentially about superficial cultural things. Like the priest invites him to a pancake dinner, and Homer says, "You found a way to turn breakfast into dinner," you know, that sort of thing. But at the end of the episode, I believe somebody has a line to the effect that, I wish I could remember the exact words, but it's something along the lines of, we should have focused on the silly things that keep us together instead of the silly things that divide us. There's this sort of poo-pooing of the differences between the different Christian churches, and I think those differences in some cases are actually rather profound. But I think The Simpsons would...
say, no, the differences don't really matter. And they would extend that view not just to the differences between different churches, but also the differences between different faiths as well.
So just an ecumenism, a pluralism.
Yeah. Well, I think you're right that The Simpsons respects a certain amount of individual belief, people doing whatever they think is right for them. So that would include Lisa's conversion to Buddhism. That's what she wants to do. But Marge is a member of the local church, but Marge will deviate from what the pastor tells her if she thinks that she has a better view of what the moral thing to do would be in any given circumstance.
And a big part of the show is this intertextuality. So things that are happening in, you know, out there in reality are brought into the show. So my guess would be that in a few weeks we'll have an episode on the Pope and the issue now facing the Catholic Church.
Well, that would be... That would be groundbreaking if an animated primetime show went after that. But picking up what you said, Peter, it seems as if the virtue of tolerance is preached, because you do have an episode where Ned Flanders and Lisa, the precocious 8-year-old, are at either end of a debate, which is kind of like the Scopes monkey trial being replayed, with Flanders predictively defending creationism and Lisa, who's a skeptic and a rationalist, kind of being an advocate of science. And at some point she makes a comment, well, I disagree with you, but I respect you. And maybe that's the lens through which we look at.
Yeah, like I think Ned Flanders' faith is respected on a certain level. I mean, he's sincere. He's not a hypocrite. The most common charge people make against religious people is that they are hypocrites. But I don't think anybody would ever say that about Ned Flanders. He's definitely sincere in what he believes and what he does. And Homer has had moments where he has said things like, if everybody here were like Ned Flanders, we wouldn't have to go to heaven. It would already be here. You know, he's
said
things
right.
like
he
that.
He said, this man has turned every cheek on his body. if everyone here were like Ned Flanders, there'd be no need for heaven. We'd already be there.
Right. But on the other hand, there are episodes where Ned Flanders has tried to force his faith on other people, like the episode where he tries to I forget if he's babysitting or if he's got custody of
Bart. He's got
Bart
custody
and Lisa.
Of Bart and Lisa, and he ends up baptizing them, and then Homer intervenes, and Bart says, "Dad, you took a baptism for me."
Exactly. Yeah, I think the show probably clearly takes the view that what Ned was doing was wrong, because he was trying to impose his religion on somebody else. But whenever Ned sort of keeps it to himself and it makes him a happier, better person, I think the show respects that. So there's a tolerance, but there's certain limits to what the show accepts.
Right. Now, we look at Flanders. He's the embodiment of evangelicalism. But there doesn't seem to be an understanding, of course, the issue is, how would you portray this? The idea of the dynamic of grace. There seems to be, as you were saying, Kevin, a consistent karmic spirituality or a performance-based spirituality that keeps popping up. So in season two, when Bart prays for God's intervention, there's a snowstorm. He gets a big heavy dropped on him by Lisa, who says, you prayed for this. You owe God big time. And then Homer, his confused theology, at one point he says, when Bart asks him what Homer's beliefs are, Homer says, you know, the one with all the well-meaning rules that don't work in real life, Christianity. And you've got Marge who prays, and certainly the praying has an authenticity, but at one point Marge prays in an episode, "Dear Lord, if you spare this town from becoming a smoking hole in the ground, I'll try to be a better Christian. I don't know what I can do. Oh, the next time there's a canned food drive, I'll give the poor something they actually like instead of old lima beans and pumpkin mix." You know, so there's a comical moment, but there's certainly not an understanding of grace. It seems as if everybody's mired in a performance-based spirituality.
Well, and that you see that in the prayers as well. The prayers on the show are almost consistently a sort of a tit for tat. If you do this, I'll do this. Or could you do this for me? Prayer is not seen as a way of getting closer to God. It's not seen as a way of meditating upon God at all, which probably is too serious for a show like The Simpsons. But the prayers that we do see on the show are almost always about, if I give you this, will you give me that? And that sort of thing.
Could you say that grace is happening in ways that they are not aware of, like that the marriage doesn't actually fall apart, even though by all
I was going to say, they're recipients of grace often, but are they recognizers? And I think what you're saying is that it's a transactional relationship with whatever spiritual world. It's not relational. Although, again, there's times when God and Homer kind of hang out, you know? And so I don't know.
But don't you think the fact that they might not recognize or realize that grace has played a part in what goes well for them, isn't that pretty realistic? Don't you think that's kind of how we all bumble along? We're not that conscious of what we've been spared or what consequences we're not having to face because of grace.
Yeah.
I think there are definitely grace-filled moments in the show, but the ones that come to mind are ones that take place within the family itself, where Bart sticks up for his sister at the summer camp, or, you know, things of that nature, where a member of the family sort of goes the extra mile for another member of the family, and the other member wasn't expecting it, and they're you know, I've said this word already, but it's a heartwarming moment where they realize that they are actually close and that at times they do stick up for each other.
You know, that's interesting. That's maybe what makes it different from Seinfeld, because, I mean, Seinfeld and The Simpsons rose at the same time, and one purposely would never have a sentimental moment, and in that same time period, you would see many sentimental moments on The Simpsons where it's almost like that, like I say, I mean, it just feels like so much of the movie takes place in the wasteland of what was America, where we have all these different cultural institutions. We don't really understand what they're for, but we're still kind of going through the motions. But every once in a while, it's like there's this glimmer of, oh, maybe that's why we're a family. Well, maybe that's why we go to church. Or maybe this is why we, you know what I mean? It's almost like that happens once in a while, you know, where that would never happen on Seinfeld.
Which rings true. Like, that seems authentic to me, that would be a realistic, as honest as you could make, you know, real life for a whole population, that those things are true, that there are institutions that we take for granted and we don't give them much thought, and then there are moments where they are shining.
Well, there's certainly poignant moments. As Peter said, there's sentimental moments. There's heartwarming moments. There's moments where gratitude is expressed to God. So Flanders says, "Dear God, thank you for Ziggy Comics, Little Baby Ducks, and Sweating to the Oldies Volume 1, 2, and 4." You know, so there's gratitude. But I guess what I'm driving at, the idea that there is a personal deity who sustains the universe and whose disposition is gracious and kind and generous and merciful is largely absent. You know, so Homer gives voice to this. The lesson is, our God is vengeful. O spiteful one, show me who to smite, and they shall be smoten, says Homer. And even Flanders, who's supposed to be the poster boy for evangelicalism, he's kosher, just to make sure. So there's this kind of thing, am I really in with God?
But you know, there's a difference though between what the characters believe and how God actually is portrayed, you know, because I mean, again, I just watched recently the episode where Homer becomes a missionary, and he ends up being trapped on this cargo plane headed towards some, what is it, Micronesian, they have a different word for it, Micro-Asian island. And he says to the pilots, "But I don't even believe in Jeebus." And then as he's flying away, he goes, "Jeebus, help me." There's an expectation that somehow if he calls out, God will help him, even though he's in over his head.
There's an expectation of divine intervention, even from the confused spiritual wanderer, Homer. And often the signal is, in case where we've zoned out, the hallelujah chorus erupts to let us know, oh, God's making a move, God's stepping in. Well, we need to make a move. We need to actually take a break. I've enjoyed the conversation with Alison, Peter, and Kevin. So it's time to refresh your drinks, get more carbohydrates. For those of you who are part of our live audience, we look forward to your questions and your comments and invite you to send your thoughtful, reflective zingers our way. We'll take them from you during this break. Thank you. So welcome back to our live audience here at Bells in South Surrey in beautiful British Columbia. This is the Kindlings Western Canada. And also welcome back to those of you listening in on the web at thekindlings.ca. We've got some great questions for our panel. And so first off is Ken, who has a question for the panel. Maybe all of the panel or pick your target, Ken, but give voice to your question.
My question was, I just could throw it out there for anybody to answer, but why has The Simpsons become more and more acceptable in mainstream society, particularly in the later years? I know that for my own kids, it's okay to watch it now, whereas in the early years, it was considered offensive, and, you know, you guys can't watch this stuff. And is it a comment on society in general that's changed, or is it The Simpsons show that's evolved more to become more mainstream, whereas other animated shows have taken the more offensive side and more cutting edge and edgy? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we got used to it, didn't we? Initially, I remember feeling it was offensive and I didn't want my kids to watch it. And I don't know, I think I wore down. It was on so long, so often. The reruns were every day. You did sort of get used to it. Though I agree that the more recent animated shows are much more offensive. Family Guy and...
Well, and I don't think they really have a goal of redemption, whereas I think, you know, The Simpsons, when it was being criticized, you know, I think it was maybe in an age, it's hard to remember 20 years ago, but when we kind of viewed any criticism as a negative, as if, oh, you can't criticize us, you know, we're right about everything. You know, and maybe it took a little while before we could learn to laugh at ourselves and realize that maybe The Simpsons wasn't trying to destroy us. Maybe it was trying to expose us or trying to provide a bit of a mirror to say, hey, you know what? There's some things that maybe we're a little bit hung up on or ridiculous about. And so I'm not sure if there's maybe a little bit of cultural accommodation, but I think it's partly maybe The Simpsons helped us a little bit. Helped us grow up a little bit.
We grew to understand it. Like, yeah. I find the satire helpful now in a way that I couldn't have 20 years ago.
Yeah. I think The Simpsons seemed a lot more subversive than it really was when it first came out, partly because it was animated, and people had the expectation that if it's a cartoon, it's got to be safe for kids. And so when the cartoon came out and there were characters using words like damn and hell, and there were Homer and Marge were being tempted in different episodes by possible adulterous partners and so forth. These are issues that existing sitcoms at the time, like Family Ties, dealt with all the time. But the fact that it was a cartoon addressing these issues made it seem really cutting edge and subversive. But we've seen tons of cartoons since then, and the cartoons that have gone much, much further than The Simpsons have gone. And so I think the fact that a cartoon might deal with these issues doesn't really faze anybody anymore. And I think also, just as time goes by, some things that used to seem rebellious just seem kind of safe. You know, in the 50s, who could have predicted that people would be singing praise songs with electric guitars? You know, just things just sort of, we just get used to things over time.
How shocking, Peter. How absolutely shocking. Thanks for your comments. Going to change gears and have a question from Dave about the Simpsons genre.
So, The Simpsons seems to epitomize the satirical and ironic comedic genre, which seems to have become the dominant form of comedy of our times. Why has that happened?
That's a deep question.
Thanks, Dave. Yeah, it's a deep question from Dave because he's a deep guy. So... And that's me just buying you time to reflect. So who wants to respond to Dave's question?
So you're asking, why is the satirical, ironic form of humor become the dominant form? Is that the...
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good question. Because it is, isn't it? Like, you can't watch Comedy Network without seeing that
same... As opposed to what, though?
Slapstick.
What was the dominant form before? Slapstick?
Slapstick. Okay. Situation comedy.
My gut reaction is to say that because we're not happy, we all sense intuitively that there's something wrong, and maybe satire is a way at trying to figure out what it is. I don't know. I think that somehow that there's a duplicity between who we say we are and who we really are, and it's something that maybe is lurking inside of us, and satire, we need satire right now to bring it out. I don't know. It also, to me, speaks of a little bit of hopelessness. But I don't know, again, when I think about it within the context of the Simpsons, there does seem to be a redemptive quality about it. Whereas I look at something like Family Guy, it just seems to be, I don't even give that really the status of being satirical or ironic. It just is just trying to tear down everything. So it doesn't even, it almost seems to me to be the tail end of some kind of a trend.
Could it also be that there's an impatience around things, as you mentioned, that are wrong with society and everyone's just getting annoyed, so that, like, I'm thinking of The Daily Show, it just pokes at whatever the hot news stories are with a satirical kind of critique that is quite effective, because we are watching these news stories and thinking, what is going on in the world? And somehow, if you come at it with satire, there's an interruption in the arrogance of those stories.
Well, even Jon Stewart, who you just mentioned, on The Daily Show, he doesn't just tear down things. There are moments where he very clearly articulates a point of view that he believes in, and that does come through at times. And your comment, Kevin, about redemptiveness kind of brings to mind a comment I think that Elvis Costello once made. He said that he was skeptical, not cynical, because skeptics have hope, cynics don't. And I think a show like Family Guy is just, you know, all-out cynical. From what little I've seen of it, it seems determined to push buttons and
it says there is no meaning, so why bother? Whereas The Simpsons seems to say there was something meaningful. What was it?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, at its best, although there are certainly episodes of The Simpsons.
Yeah.
You know, when you make a 450 episodes, you're going to find all sorts. You'll find whatever you're looking for, really.
Yeah, you got dozens of writers and producers, and it's going to shift according to their personalities.
But at its best, The Simpsons does have the hope that comes with skepticism.
Right.
That there is satire, there is a subverting of our expectations if we are expecting things to carry on as normal, but the things that are carry on as normal are deeply wrong on some level. When things are wrong, it's satire can help to subvert that and make us look at it differently and look and think about it differently, and hopefully get us to rethink things and make things better. Whereas cynicism just puts everything down and has no hope beyond that.
Well, I think satire in its highest form is a form of prophecy fulfilling the office of a prophet in society.
Well, in the 1980s, before The Simpsons came out, you know, the Christian rock musician, and again, in the 50s, who could have imagined such a thing would ever exist? But in the 1980s, one of my favorite Christian rock musicians was a guy called Steve Taylor, who was very satirical in his songs, and whether it was Steve or his followers, defenders, I was one of them, one of the things that always came up was, well, look at Elijah and the comments he made about Baal during the contest with the prophets of Baal. Very satirical. Oh, where's your God? He's on the can. He's gone for a nap. Oh, whatever. And, you know, yeah, there's definitely a role for satire, definitely in prophecy.
All right. Thanks for your comments, panel. We're going to get Steve to pose a question, maybe to Allison. So, Allison, You get ready, shed your frustration, and give us your illumination.
You mentioned that about how The Simpsons portrays women, and with Lisa and Marge being the housewife and such. But there was actually an episode where Lisa was thrown into the future with Bart, where she was a very successful businesswoman, and Bart was like swinging a wrecking ball and that sort of thing. How does that change how The Simpsons views women?
Yeah, I didn't see that episode, so thank you for pointing it out. I don't know if it changes my concerns about the underachievement of boys in our culture and the overachievement of girls that's been pretty steady for the last 20 years. So I do think that the gender roles are still not that, I don't know, thorough or something, that a girl achieving certain grades in school does not necessarily equate to success. I mean, okay, in that one episode that Lisa was a successful bank manager, the one that you're referring to, that there was success coming her way because she was so obviously competent. I mean, that's great. That actually is exciting for me, because most of the research suggests that even with high-achieving girls, there is not a long-term success in those ways for most girls going through our school system now. And in the same way, even the underachievement of boys does not mean they underachieve through life. They actually do quite well anyway. So in a way, if that episode sort of rewarded Lisa for her diligence and competence, that's actually very affirming. I do wonder if if the show is more popular with men than with women. And I have a feeling it is. I mean, I don't know what the stats would be, but I did do a little survey of all my friends, and my female friends all could take it or leave it. You know, they might have seen an episode with their family.
Maybe they washed their hair on a Sunday evening, Allison. just a little joke there.
I didn't hear the joke.
Okay, yeah, it wasn't much of a joke.
Okay,
sorry. That's okay. Hey, we've got a comment here from Brent, who's nestled at the bar. Brent.
My question is close to the first question, dealing with, in some ways, is The Simpsons in some ways responsible for shows like South Park and Family Guy, and it's these shows that seem to kind of resonate more with, you know, a lot of teenagers and youth today. And I'm just wondering, is there a certain continuity with The Simpsons and South Park and Family Guy, or do you see it as discontinuous?
Well, certainly the success of The Simpsons showed that other cartoons could try for a similar kind of success, just as the success of Pixar movies opened the door for lots of other computer animated cartoons, you could argue. But I wouldn't say that Pixar is responsible for any particular DreamWorks cartoon or anything like that. And I don't know how close a line we can draw between The Simpsons and any of the other shows that are out there. Certainly, it's widened the playing field for cartoons in general. As for the current generation, you know, I have a babysitter at home right now looking after my kids. She's 19, and we were talking about this on my way out the door, and she said she prefers Family Guy to The Simpsons, and, you know, Simpsons is sort of, she couldn't, you know, as Allison said, it's sort of neither here nor there for her, so.
The Simpsons has kind of become a little bit quaint, actually, which is hard to believe.
Yeah, is it still on? But some of my friends said, oh, is it still, really, 20 years, it's still going, or it's over? No, I think it's still going. Oh.
Well, two other series you have to remember, too, is I think if you look at what would be a predecessor to Family Guy or South Park would be Beavis and Butthead, you know, and then there's also, King of the Hill is in the mix there, too. But, I mean, in terms of, you know, grandfathers of the genre, Beavis and Butthead, again, showed that you could make a cartoon for adults, you know, and it definitely is the more juvenile humor that you're going to see on South Park. You know, where Simpsons, I think, or Family Guy, for instance, Simpsons and King of the Hill are very similar, I think, in that they go for much more of a four-quadrant audience, you know, mother, father, daughter, son. Like, they're really shows that are more for a family, you know. So I think I would agree with Peter is that what it did was show you can make a cartoon for adults, but in terms of the directions that they've gone, I can't think that you can draw a connection.
Arnold has a question.
Well, Pastor Bill, knowing that the jovial character that you are, we know that you would embrace all the Simpsons as part of your church. However, I was just wondering if you had to just select one and only one of the characters to be part of your congregation, which one would you select?
Wow. So I've got people speaking on my behalf. We've got Allison chanting Lisa.
Yeah.
We've got someone suggesting Bart, the underachiever and proud of it. I think Krusty the Clown would be a great asset to children's ministry. and certainly, as a pastor, one of the things that appeals to me about the church that gathers under Reverend Lovejoy's rather dreadful sermons is how eclectic that group is. Because I want to pastor a come-as-you-are church. Where people across the spiritual continuum are given permission and space to explore the claims of Jesus. But you've asked me only one. I would say Homer. You know, because he embodies the spiritually confused. You know, he's really a prodigal and a wanderer. And I don't want to lead a church that's populated by the already convinced. I want to see a church that's got room for prodigals, people who've lost their way, who are unchurched, de-churched, unconvinced, and have the opportunity to influence them. So since you said one, Homer, and then I might get a package deal because then Marge and Baby Maggie and Bart and Lisa, the Buddhist, will be reconverted to the pursuit of Jesus. So that's what I'm saying. But it's almost time for us to wrap up. And what we try and do is allow our panel to make a final comment as we try and review the terrain we've covered, which is a rather uneven terrain tonight, as we've talked about issues of nuclear family, familial dysfunction, gender, and spirituality. But hopefully, as I look at Alison, which means she's the first one who's going to have to come up with a compelling soundbite, they've got something inspiring or uplifting or thought-provoking to propel you into the parking lot tonight and leave you musing after our Kindlings podcast. So, Alison, final comment.
I think that the continued popularity of the show has something to do with its obsession with family life and the dysfunction it's called, but maybe just the honest reality of what it takes to put together a life in a real, genuine way.
Thank you, Alison. Peter.
As you say, the terrain is very uneven, so I don't know how to sum it all up except to say that...
Okay, Kevin.
Okay. No, I still have very fond memories of the early seasons of The Simpsons, especially when it allowed for, I think, a little more sincerity among the jokes. But it's at its best, it's a wonderfully funny, pop culture savvy, and to a point, religiously minded show, because it acknowledges that religion's a part of our lives, and just even by acknowledging that, it does us a favor.
Thanks, Peter. Kevin?
You know, part of me just finds it a little bit amusing that we're giving so much attention to an animated TV show, but then I look at books called The Philosophy of The Simpsons and The Gospel According to The Simpsons, and clearly it's had a really huge impact on the culture. It's kind of odd to think about that. And for me, it comes down to the person of Homer Simpson as well. And I just sit here and think about, why do I love that man? And, you know, boy, you know, even though I don't really watch the show, I'm going to miss him when he's gone, you know, when he's no longer doing new things that we can laugh about. And I guess it must be because I can identify with him on some level or another. I was saying to Allison during the break, I think, that Homer kind of represents, I have four kids, he represents, you know, when everything has been sucked out of me and I have nothing, I feel like I have nothing left to give and I just stop kicking and I drift down to the bottom. That's what I become, is the, you know, the lowest common denominator. I don't know. But anyway, yeah, that's sad to admit in public.
But thank you for that honesty. But,
thanks but, for bearing yeah. your soul, my son.
Yeah. But anyway, just to say that I think that why do I love the show? I mean, I think it's really important, even though this seems like a trivial thing, to ask, why is it such a big deal for so many people? What does that say about us? What is perhaps God trying to tell us through The Simpsons? That, I don't know. I mean, but I think it's worth giving it a second look and thinking about it.
All right. Well, we've been in the company of Alison Joe, Peter Chataway, and Kevin Miller. To our live audience, thanks so much for joining us this evening. We meet here the last Monday of each month. So next month, we're going to take a look at social media, Facebook, Twitter, tweeting, MySpace, our obsession with emails, and use Neil Postman as a text to analyze all this new electronic social media. Postman wrote a book about television, amusing ourselves to death. So next month we ask the question, are we, with Facebook and Twitter and its proliferation of tweets, are we amusing ourselves to death? So I invite you to return and bring someone with you, and also to check out our website for podcasts and blogs. Thanks so much for joining us at the Kindlings.